I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Joy today to welcome Lauren Buckman, who is the fifth president of Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, as our guest on Conversing. He really is an international leader in art and design education and has been doing this really his whole adult life in various places and in various contexts. But we have come to know one another by being leaders of institutions in Pasadena, and I have just continuously grown regard and affection for Lauren and for who he is and for what he does in the world. So, Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
It's an honor, Mark. Thank you for having me.
One of the things that has been most delightful to discover over the years that our friendship has unfolded has been the sense and sensibility that is about who you are as a person who works, in the one hand, now leading a college of design, and on the other hand, and intertwined with that, a person of very deep spiritual and personal character that engages with the creative process. So I wonder if you could just start by just informing listeners a little bit about yourself and how all these things have been held together in your being.
Well, they hover anyway, whether or not
Touché.
They hold together. Yeah. Formally, my education is in the theater. I did a PhD in theater at Stanford. And what interested me about that program, which actually has relevance to my life now, is that Stanford offered a PhD that was at once practical and applied and scholarly at the same time, so that you are trained as a theater director and you're trained as a theater scholar in literature and criticism and history, etc., simultaneously, with the idea that what you discover and learn in the rehearsal hall nourishes who you are as a scholar, and what you do in scholarship and in criticism is informed by a practical sense of how the theater works. And that was the basis of it. I say it's relevant only because Art Center and the Art and Design Colleges that I've been so fortunate to be part of also work with that mutually nourishing relationship between artistic practice and scholarship. And the two blend very beautifully. So that's informed my life in very important ways.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We're head of two quite different schools, and yet there is a kind of resonance between the two schools in my own heart, partly because of you, but also because of the artistic enterprise and the creative design enterprise, which I think is surprisingly like Christian ministry in actual fact, and that these two things are really not so dissimilar, even though one is in an explicitly Christian context, one is a secular school, but yet the reality, the underlying experience of what it means to be human, to be creative, to be present to the world, to be invested in its well-being, in beauty, in community, these are things that our schools really hold deeply in common. And I know that part of the reason why these things are held together for you is because of your own spiritual background. I wonder if you could just share a bit about that.
Raised in a fairly traditional Jewish home in Toronto, Canada, and my parents were first generation grandparents who I was fortunate to know came to Canada from Poland in the early part of the 20th century, but also many stories of family, especially on my father's father's side, who had perished in the Holocaust, brought up with not an Orthodox home, but very traditional, pretty intense Jewish education, strong Jewish values that way, but always, again, with the sense of a community that was just trying to find its way in the new world, really. And I was very aware of that as a child, especially with grandparents and some of the older aunts and uncles. And that's always been something that's informed me. My own spiritual life has stayed within the Jewish world, but it's gone within many directions. And as you point out, I think a lot of my own kind of spiritual quest and discovery has become fundamentally linked to the creative world and what that's about. And that my interest has become, especially in this last book that I've written, my interest has become so much about what it means to go into uncertainty. As unsettling as a space that uncertainty might be, It's also, I think, a deeply creative space. And as you were just pointing out, it's also, I think, a spiritual space.
Right, right.
Perhaps because of its uncertainty and what we do within that space of uncertainty to discover, to feel, to know, to dig deep in ourselves, to understand who we might be in that uncertainty. And so I would really define a lot of my own spiritual life as fundamentally linked to that experience.
Right, right. Well, I think one of the things that I have most admired and delighted in discovering about you is how much you seem able and willing to live as what I have come to think of sometimes as an unguarded spirit. And I use that as high praise because I think there's so many reasons, especially in places of uncertainty, to become guarded, defensive, protective, defended. And to be an unguarded, vulnerable, and honest spirit is really quite an amazing thing, not least when you're standing in the crossfire of higher education, but also in the corporate design world, combined with the higher educational world, combined with these underlying spiritual dimensions of imagination and creativity. Can you just say a bit more about how all those things come together? What do you do that nurtures holding those things together?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is the way we choose to work on ourselves, the way in which we, through whatever means we might have, I mean, I happen to have some very wonderful support this way, to understand our behaviors, understand our patterns, understand what might be unconscious that we need to bring to consciousness and to greater authenticity. The Jungian psychoanalyst James Hollis has become a very good friend, but he's also, before we became friends, somebody who really helped me understand my own path from a place of an acquired personality that was manufactured to deal with the demands and frightening parts of the world and as what was essentially an anxiety management mechanism, to a place of at least making a commitment to a life of greater authenticity. I don't think we necessarily arrived there. I certainly haven't. But a commitment to do that, and maybe to bring some of the unconscious to unconsciousness. What Jim says, which I think is both profound and hilarious, is that the problem with the unconscious is that it's unconscious. And so that our work has to do with really trying to bring that out. And, you know, what is guiding us? What is causing those blocks to emerge? What is getting in the way of our being authentic or unguarded? And to look at those and to have the support and strength and maybe even courage to wrestle with them, to take a pause when that is happening.
Right.
To know in this world of higher ed leadership that you and I are involved in, that it's so clear to me there are moments when my reptilian brain is responding to what is going on and learning, oh God, how many times I've had to learn this, to just wait until some of the information reaches my frontal lobe, you know, and that maybe I would deal with it in a different way, or the kind of defensiveness that comes from ego or whatever button has to be pushed, that if I just relax and understand what those might be, maybe I might have a more leveled, calmer, and ultimately more helpful response to a situation.
Right.
And so I think that's how I would talk about it, that authenticity, waiting, understanding what gets in the way, knowing myself and my buttons, watching myself as I engage so that maybe a higher part of my soul might come through. I think what's also really interesting, and I don't know if this experience resonates with you, that when I do that and drop the defense, drop the guard, and engage on a more honest level,
right,
I feel so much better.
Right. Right, right.
But I have to work to get there each time.
Yes, yes. When our sons were teenagers, I remember sometimes quietly placing my hands on their forehead and just saying, come frontal cortex. Just yes. Knowing that it would all go so much better when we had a whole brain we were dealing with. And the same is certainly true in my own life. And I do think that it intersects with exactly the kind of challenges that you're describing. And I too certainly have to go through that personal process of being sure that I'm as present to the moment and as in touch with the range of internal responses that I'm having to anything as possible for hopefully a more constructive and honest and productive conversation or exchange or decision or whatever it might be. You know, I think this is a big part of why this book that you've written that I'm very anxious to read that I want you to talk about now. It hasn't yet been released, but it's a book that we've discussed a number of times, and I want you to give us a foretaste. The title of the book is Make to Know, From Spaces of Uncertainty to Creative Discovery. It's really a wonderful title, Make to Know, From Spaces of Uncertainty to Creative Discovery. In a way, that's what you were just sketching on your own psychological level. But take us into the book and give us a foretaste. I think it comes out in the fall, and I've found it already present on Amazon. So I look forward to a chance to read it. Give us a taste.
Well, what interests me about that, Mark, is that we tend to assume that artists and creative people work to manifest some kind of vision that they already possess. And the kind of paradigm of that is Michelangelo, who sees the angel in the stone and carves away until he sets it free.
Yes.
You know, he sees it there. And when you talk to most artists and designers, their process is actually very different. They have a question, an urge, a notion. They're struggling with a problem. Sometimes they just have some sort of physical sensation. It's interesting, one poet said that. And then they go about trying to work with it, to make with it, and to explore in a place of uncertainty what might come of it. So I've always been fascinated with authors who say, you know, the book wrote itself, or that writers typically looking at that blank page and saying, oh my God, it's an incredibly intimidating reality to look at that blank page. But then they begin to, as one of the people I interviewed talks about, they move words around, they begin to make, they begin to shape, they begin to engage materials. They're dealing with that blank canvas. They're dealing with that blank page. They're going into these spaces of the unknown in order to discover. And what fascinates me is as they make, as writers with words, as painters with material, as performers with space and time and context, whatever the practice might be, as they make, they come to know the thing they wish to make. Epitomized by the notion of improvisation, which itself is a great phenomenon, that the making of the thing and the thing made are one and the same. And so that's a great way to understand what I mean by make to know. And what I do is I interviewed, and I, you know, the great fortune of being at an institution like Art Center, I'm surrounded by all these incredibly brilliant artists and designers, and went to explore this notion. And before I go on to tell you what they said, I'll tell you that my own personal experience, and the reason I had a passion for this, is because that was how I recognized myself as a writer. I mean, I wrote a book on Shakespeare many years ago. I realized I wasn't sure at all what I had to say until I began the process of writing it and discovering it through the process of writing it. I think that's true as a teacher and my experience in the classroom. I think it's true as a theater director. Certainly, I was always amazed by directors who could look at a text and kind of write blocking notes and staging notes in the margins and then go into rehearsal and just make it. I could never do that. But when I was in the rehearsal space, when I was engaging with real actors in real space, moving them around in three dimension, it came to me. I was able to begin that process because I was making and moving things around and engaged that way. And I'll tell you that it's completely true from my own personal experience as a college president, too.
Right.
And I confess that when people ask me, what's your vision for the college? I always get a little anxious and nervous about that because I kept thinking, well, I need to tell them about the angel in the stone. And honestly, I don't know what it is. But I have values and I have experience and I have education and I have community. And that helps me develop the kind of direction or the kind of sense or the kind of purpose that I see. It gives me a frame or a context for the college. But what I like to say is our values, our ethics, our education, our experience, that's the scaffolding that we stand on as we reach into uncertainty.
Right, right. Exactly.
It's not the thing itself. It's the support mechanisms for us to do that and to have the courage to do that with our communities to discover what the college should be, what the play needs to be, what the writing needs to articulate, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, yeah.
And so that's the fundamental principle of make to know. And if I may, I can continue to tell the story.
Please, yes. I want to hear it.
So this was my personal experience. And then I began to talk to artists and designers about that to see if they also thought so. And every time I've had a conversation about make to know, nobody's ever looked at me quizzically saying, I don't really get what you mean.
Right.
most often people respond, oh yeah, that makes total sense and it resonates with my experience. But what was interesting is artists and designers would say, good grief, I mean, that's exactly how I work and I've never really named it. I've never labeled it that.
Yes, yes.
But
yes.
I don't have the vision.
Right.
I have the making and I have the context and I have the conditions for discovery.
Right, right.
So then I thought, well, if everybody gets this so quickly, you know, what am I telling everybody? The sky is blue here, right? And so I began to do a little bit of study and try to explore exactly why this seems like at once so familiar and unrecognizable or unspoken, you know, not talked about. And what I came up with was really a study, at least through Western culture, of three things that seem to skew our sense of creativity. One is a preoccupation with genius, which persists today. It goes clearly back to the ancients. A second one is a preoccupation with the association of creativity and madness, which also go back to ancient times. And the third really is a preoccupation with the muse, with the kind of inspiration that somehow creativity is associated with a select group who can channel the gods. And if you study that history, you begin to understand what has shaped our sense of creativity and what has shaped our sense of the work of the artist. And by the way, I'm not claiming that there aren't geniuses among us. There are many. But our preoccupation with genius has narrowed our definition of who can be creative and what we understand as creative. And in a way, Make to Know democratizes that in an interesting way.
I would think part of the reason why it has this resonance of familiarity, but perhaps not articulation, is that life itself is making to know, right? It is how human development occurs. It's what children are doing when they're playing. It's not articulated in those ways, but that's basically what child development is really meant to create. And a rich childhood is a childhood that creates whatever spaces there can be for the exercise of make to know, right? That's what they are discovering. And I think the interesting counterpoint to that is parents often and or adults who are convinced that the make to know process has to be sometimes overshaped. It has to be particularized, like those jokes about art flashcards to the 6-month-old baby in the crib, you know, trying to quiz them on which artist the flashcard might be, as though it really needs to be channeled in a very objectified kind of way rather than in a discovered-like way. And I've always been moved by the art of children for that reason, that it seems as though they really do see and know much more than we might ever imagine. How that unfolds or doesn't is what distinguishes sometimes people who choose an artistic career or an artistic life versus those who don't, right? Not entirely. I'm not trying to create a binary. I'm just saying there's a kind of orientation to those who understand that in their being in such a way they couldn't imagine living otherwise. Am I getting it or is that...
You're totally getting it. And you anticipate actually... You know, you can skip to the last chapter of the book when you get it, because I do think understanding make to know, and in terms of A, the implications with how we live, but B, that it is very much an everyday experience. And in fact, I do talk at one point with fascination about how a toddler learns to walk as a clear indication of make to know, especially when they're holding the transitional object to help them go into uncertainty. And that is profound uncertainty when you haven't ever walked before and what is discovered along the way. Another one that's quite interesting in terms of our everyday experience is speech. Speech is fundamentally make to know.
Yes.
You and I are speaking right now. There's no script here, right? We are, in fact, discovering what we want to say as we say it. It gets formed, and I have the experience all the time of discovering as I speak, as I make speech.
Yes, yes.
My thoughts come to me, and I understand them. And something as regular as everyday speech, with, again, we have experience, we have a vocabulary, we have grammar, we have an apparatus of language. That's the scaffolding. But how we use it, we stand on that to reach into the places of uncertainty in which speech takes form and helps us understand, helps us form our thinking, as does writing. One of the fascinating elements of this is that make to know is not simply about discovering what it is you want to create as a product, but it's fundamentally a way in which we know ourselves. And Joan Didion is particularly articulate about this, in which she says, I would have no reason to write if I could access my thoughts in any other way.
Right. I remember that quotation of hers. It captures this trust in the necessity and the delight and wonder of improvisational knowing, which can only be made.
Exactly right. Yeah.
I think I've told you before that there was a good friend of ours who's a very fine artist. And she declared one day that she was quite sure that I would love painting. And I said, no, I'm really quite sure I would not love painting because, well, I love creative things. That's just not one that I've ever even imagined myself doing. So she said, no, it's really, you would really love it. So one day she appears at our door with the gift of a pristine 4-foot by 6-foot canvas and a bunch of paints. And she said, really, you should just take this and just play and enjoy it. And after having come by our house a few times in between, she said to me one day, I've noticed that the canvas is still in the garage untouched. So I wonder if I could come over and we could play together on the canvas. So she did that. And it was itself a breakthrough experience just to be with somebody who really is a very fine artist, just still reveling in the delight of paint on a canvas, right? And everything about it. So we had this great experience. And essentially what she opened to me is not a great painting career, but instead the unbelievable delight of playing with paint on canvas, which became for me this free fall where I knew nothing about actually doing this, except that I knew what you were naming earlier. I knew who I was. I knew how my body worked. I knew how to conceive of color. I knew how I was willing to take risks, how I determined at the beginning of my experience that I didn't want to take any classes because I only wanted to know whatever I could discover through actually doing it rather than through being told how to do it. Not that there isn't a place, obviously, for that, but more because for me, it felt like I just want pure improvisation with no consequences in my case. No measurements, no boundaries, just let it unfold in whatever way it occurs to me. And for about, 4 or 5 years, I painted at least twice a day on the grounds of just the pure delight of improvisational work that I knew nothing about, except what I was coming to know through painting. So when I heard that you were writing this book, I thought that's a book for me because it would no doubt help me gain insight into what this process really is and why it plays as it does. But it's really partly what I've appreciated about you personally and your own manifestation of this, but also that part of my own experience.
Well, you touch on two really important elements of the make-to-know process, to me anyway. One is, as you just described it, it's engaging with materials.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the experience of engaging with materials and how much the making that is engaging with materials is a way to knowing so many things on so many different levels. Not the least of which is the wonder and beauty and miracle of the materials themselves and our engagement with them and how that relationship then opens up all kinds of possibilities and discoveries.
Right.
Yeah, exactly right. So that's one. And the other one is, as I was alluding to before, is to what improvisation is and how much improvisation is so much of our lives, really.
Right.
And such a necessary element of our lives. And you can geek out on improvisation because it touches everything. When you begin to think about it and you get into that kind of improvisational mind, the world becomes very improvisational in a lot of ways. And here's the thing that I think is really important. It doesn't mean that we're making it up as we go along.
Right.
I think that's the mistake in all of this. And that's maybe what we're afraid of. It actually requires enormous skill. You know, an interesting thing about improvisation is it cannot come from nothing. You need context or frame or melody or prompt or material or problem or community. It's always somehow tied to that. And then there is a frame in which something can then begin to happen. And I explored even the free improvisers musically who claim that they are absolutely free. But of course, you get to a point where there has to be a grammar that they're working with. There has to be some sort of relationship that exists with each other as they're producing this music. There has to be a moment of exchange with audience, all of which form these frames, looser maybe than Miles Davis playing Summertime. But nonetheless, they are frames in which discovery and extemporaneous creation of the moment takes place.
Right. I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. In this process of writing this book, were there really significant surprises to you, like things that you really didn't see coming that somehow became clear to you?
The one that I think, whether it was a surprise or a recognition, and I say that only because that's a distinction I try to explore in the book, because some artists talk about the fact that they were surprised, and others, like the brilliant artist Anne Hamilton, says, no, it's all about recognition. It's all about you create the conditions for you to recognize what it is you need to create.
Yeah.
And the difference between surprise and recognition, I think, is a fascinating one. Yeah. But the surprise was, and, you know, it's so in my body now that it's no longer a surprise, that the most common statement made by really hundreds of interviews was the following phrase: I thought of the idea in the shower.
Amazing.
Yeah, that we think about the creative work we do or any work we do to be of the moment at the desk, in the studio, in the rehearsal hall, whatever the case may be. But in fact, something important about leaving it, being in another context, that there is actually a continuum of creativity.
Right, right.
And when we find ourselves in a different, you know, for some people, it's, you know, they're driving their car and their mind is freed up to wander, or they're in the shower, or they're simply in a different place. Or Amy Tan, the writer, talks about, you know, I get into this framework, a cosmology, she calls it, and I'm trying to write and I'm trying to solve something. And I go to the shelf and I pick up a book and I open it. And that chapter heading right there in the middle of that book is exactly what I need. It's perfect. It's right there.
Yeah.
So there are all these different levels, all these different ways in which we discover when we also are expanding our context, creating different conditions for discovery and realizing that there's a full spectrum of activity going on. And that sometimes when we're just shampooing our hair, that's when the great idea is going to come. The problem is, can you remember it when you're out of the shower, right?
Yes. Yeah. The dream can be the same kind of thing, I think, sometimes.
Well, and now that you talk about dreaming, there's also, and I touch on this a bit too, there, I mean, neuroscience once again comes through in all kinds of interesting ways. And some of the studies that have been conducted in functional MRI machines, where there's been studies on the brain on improvisation and what gets lit up at that particular moment.
So do tell.
Right. Well, one of the things is the medial prefrontal cortex, which has been referred to in a lot of different ways, but it's kind of our, the one I like most is our center for autobiography, right? That's the piece. And also, by the way, the center of the brain that's responsible for speech lights up too, in reference to what I was just saying earlier as well. But when you think about the fact that when you're improvising something, it's linked to some part of the brain that's responsible for our own stories, it becomes a really interesting way, again, of exploring who we are and how we discover ourselves and how we know ourselves in that making slash improvisational context.
Hmm. Well, I'd love to go back to the things you were just saying about kind of the roots of some of the challenges, genius, madness, and muse. I remember having this experience once when I was getting on a plane and I thought I had started a recording of a new album by Joshua Bell. And I was expecting it to just be audio. But suddenly I looked down at my phone and here was Joshua Bell playing one of the pieces of music that I was planning to just listen to. And I was just beyond enraptured by this experience. It was utterly transformative to me. And I felt as though when it was done, I was breathless, just sitting on the plane, still on the tarmac, hadn't moved from the gate. And I felt like I wanted to go up and say to one of the flight attendants, I just need the microphone to announce that I've just had a life-changing experience and that I want everyone to share in it with me. Now, what was that about? That was about, for me, it was about experiencing the wonder of beauty, the wonder of genius. There is a kind of madness, I have to say, that has sometimes struck me about Joshua Bell and other musicians like him that feel or sometimes come across with a kind of sense of being possessed by what it is that they're doing. And whether that's a muse or not, there's something highly elevated. Now, I will say also that the other undertow was exactly the opposite, which was discouragement, being overwhelmed by the fact that I don't consider myself, nor am I, a genius. Nor am I mad, nor am I muse-filled. So there was the opposite side was, this is so discouraging because I can acknowledge and celebrate it and be so grateful for it, but I can also be undone by it in the very same moment. What do you make of that besides the call for more therapy?
No, I think your framework is exactly right. And as I was saying before, I just think that the association with genius and madness and some sort of divine inspiration, I don't mean to suggest that that doesn't exist. What I mean to suggest is it narrows how we think about creativity.
Yes, right.
It narrows who we think can be creative. And so it ties exactly to the experience you just articulated. And I remember and know the same for myself. But especially as a child, I remember I'm not creative. Geniuses are creative. There's a very specific way in which that gets defined. And that's, I think we're missing a great opportunity in life if we're conditioned to think that way.
Right, right.
As opposed to really being able to discover who we are as creative beings, whether we're genius or not.
Right.
And I think, moreover, that genius has become a preoccupation of our culture that not only skews our sense of creativity, but creates almost a caste system in terms of who really gets to speak and who really gets to express. And when you start looking at it, we're obsessed with genius. It's a kind of addiction. The number of films you can think of that spotlight genius, the books that are constantly written, the preoccupation. If you Google my child and genius, you'll see endless entries of how your two-year-old is a genius or how to make your two-year-old a genius or whatever the case is. It's all over the place. And it just seems to me, it's not the question. It's not what's interesting, even though God knows there are geniuses among us.
Right. Well, this is my tension often in going to museums, right? Because they're places of such illumination, fascination, attraction, surprise, shock, everything that part of the human emotion spectrum that I experience when I'm in a museum filled with great art. But it really is an experience of endless testimonies to genius in most cases. That's not the world that I live in. It's not the world of ordinary genius that I think is actually equally as profound, but never cataloged, never auctioned, never owned as a possession, but is a profound form of ordinary genius that comes through the way simple artisans as bread makers know what to do with bread and pastry and vegetables and so many other things that would never be cataloged in that same way. They're not going to be photographed, but they are works of, to me, tactile beauty, cultural beauty, ethnic beauty, racial beauty, gender beauty that really have to do with the very particularity of a given person in a location with materials, doing something that they bring together in a way that no one else does. It's an astounding thing.
And look what happens just to our experience of life and the beauty of the world when one begins to think that way.
Right.
Right. And it's interesting that you use the terms you did, because the very etymology and history of genius is very itself narrow, very male, very white, and it has very specific kinds of associations with it from ancient Roman times, where it was a kind of guardian spirit, through Kant and the Enlightenment, where it became, it's not so much that you were visited by genius as we were in ancient times. It became that you are genius. It became internal and therefore a very important part of the Romantic sensibility as well, but very narrowly defined and exclusionary in a kind of fundamental way as well, right? Whereas when you open it up in the way you just did, it becomes something that just exposes something about human experience that I think is very profound and very important for us to appreciate, right? I'd also say that when you begin to internalize that just in terms of one's own growth and one's own sense of appreciation and engagement with the world, and you start applying these notions of entering uncertainty as a creative activity, engaging with the materials of the world as a living being, solving problems as designers teach us and what that means and the creativity that's involved in that, and seeing the activity through the lens of that process and that designers make so evident to us. And then fundamentally improvisation, as we have said. I mean, those four elements are so key to who we are, how we can engage, how we can think of ourselves as everyday creative beings. And as we were alluding earlier, I think the connection with spirituality for me is profound. Because if you think about those things, entering uncertainty, you and I have talked about improvisation and even improvisation in prayer and what that means, that entering uncertainty, improvisation, engaging with material, I mean, think about any kind of ritualistic experience and what's involved in that, right? And the problem solving, the thinking through, the creative way in which we want to open up possibility through that kind of engagement and with the kinds of questions that beget questions, etc. I mean, there's so many examples of that, right?
Well, I think this is partly, again, why our chemistry has been strong, because I do sense that that's exactly what you're doing. And I think I sense that that's what I'm trying to do in a theological educational context. And the convergence of these things seem really quite obvious to me, but don't always seem obvious to people who are used to thinking in different categories. And I think one of the great gifts of a theological education, one of the great gifts of religious practice, in my case, Christian practice, is the way that it can not only create, but encourage this kind of creativity in the most profound and deep and transformative and interpersonal, communal, materialist sense that makes sense of the world, which is why, for me, the idea of moving from pastoral ministry to theological education felt to me like a significant set of changes and losses. But one of the things that I most loved about being a pastor is the endless improvisation with every person that you're ever working with in a context of pastoral ministry, which encompasses an extraordinary array of personalities and life experiences and traumas and joys and imagination and so forth. And to be with people, which is often what pastoral care means, care of souls, is really about attending to them carefully in order for them to be able to see themselves in a way that is honoring and reflective of who they really are. I remember over this strange COVID season, remembering that many, many years ago when I was in grade school, there was a boy that was 2 years older than I was who played the oboe in the most extraordinary way. And I always thought I could never be like him because I'm not a genius. It was the same scenario again. And what was so fascinating was that maybe now 20 years ago, I was walking along the street in Berkeley on Shattuck Avenue, and I thought I saw a sign that said that this music store rented clarinets. I walked in, I said, "Do you rent oboes?" They said, "Yes." I said, "I'd like to rent one, please." So 5 minutes later, I walked out with a rented oboe, and I then studied oboe for the next 4 or 5 years. Various things caused me to have to stop doing that. But it was a marvelous experience, thrilling to me. During the pandemic, I had a mental space one day where I thought, I wonder if I could find that person and just say how much his playing of the oboe had inspired me. I was able to track him down, and he told me the story of his oboe. And I said, but let me tell you the story of my experience of you playing the oboe, because it was transfixing. It was like a magical instrument to me. And what was interesting was he did play the oboe very seriously for a long time and had now played it for a very long time. And it seemed unimaginable to me to think that he could have this in him, this capacity, and not express it. So I wonder what allows us to step into creativity and out of a certain expression of creativity. I mean, in my case, it was circumstances that derailed that time that I had available to study the oboe. But I'm just wondering how you think about that in light of this making business.
Well, as we were speaking, I was thinking, you know, earlier when I was reflecting on my own background and my own experience in Judaism, that what I didn't say was that it's been a lifelong kind of struggle with at once being incredibly drawn and wanting it and feeling misplaced or even alienated along the way, and that that really has been a struggle. What some of this work has helped me understand is that in that tension, there is something creative, and I dare say spiritual itself, and to kind of watch that and watch me as I engage in this, if you will, making of my spiritual life, which is going to have blocks, which is going to have times where it flows, which is going to have times where I'm in the synagogue trying to find my heart connection with what's going on, but in fact, nothing's happening. And then the next day in the shower.
Right.
Yeah, don't tell the rabbis about that. But in any case, that or driving home,
maybe
a better, or something. But that also in that continuum, there can be moments and when I'm not trying to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I'm opening up another part of me
Yes.
for it to come. So I think that's true of my experience, and that keeps going in all kinds of interesting ways. I think that's one thing. The other thing I would say is there is such thing as talent, for sure. And maybe this oboe player had a capacity to find it and to create it and to reach a certain level that, no aspersions your way, maybe you reached it too, I don't know. But I mean, I certainly wouldn't have been able to reach any kind of level of that because I don't have the talent. But I think, again, talent is a kind of blessing of abundance or capaciousness to be able to engage in a certain kind of way. It doesn't necessarily mean that the creative process or the creative engagement is not available to those who don't possess the same kind of talent. It echoes what I was saying about genius before, too.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think is so interesting about the world that you occupy at Art Center is the fact that it's both fine art and also industrial art, art that is meant to be for the sake of design of things that actually do things in the world and that perform in certain ways and that function in certain ways that bring beauty, but also speed in the case of cars to a person's life and experience. I'm just curious how the more humanist side of this and the more industrial qualities, the so-called usefulness of creativity, live together.
Oh, that's such a great question. There's so many ways I could talk about that. I think one of the things I would say is that, as I was alluding to before, designers make to know through what is axiomatic to the design, and that's solving problems, right? That's so much about what designers do. I mean, there are some designers now, actually, who try to talk about it in a different kind of way. But fundamentally, all the designers I interviewed for the book and that I've engaged with at Art Center really do talk about it as problem solving. And sometimes it's not even, as far as the user's concerned, that the user doesn't really even realize that there's a problem. A classic example is the evolution of the iPod. Really, what problem did it solve? I mean, once the technology was there, then the designer had to really work with the why of it and what problem did it solve? Well, if this is a problem, fairly first world, but nonetheless, it solved the problem that we didn't have our music when we were walking. We didn't have our music when we were exercising. We couldn't affix it to our lapel. We couldn't listen to it while we were floating in a canoe. Not exactly a problem, but in fact, what it did was it consolidated those huge record collections we used to have, and we could walk around with it and listen to it at any particular point, with kind of Walkman as a prelude to that. And then eventually the solution became that it became integrated into our smartphones. God forbid we should have more than one device that we're walking around with. But all design is about problem solving. And often, traditionally, the way we've talked about design as educators is we say to people, look around you, any space you're in, any place you're in, the chair you're sitting on, the walls that surround you, the clothes you're wearing, the glasses you're wearing, somebody designed it. Somebody thought about them. Somebody thought about them in terms of solving a problem, that you needed to have a comfortable place to sit, or you need to keep warm with the clothing you're wearing. You need, whatever the case may be, somebody thought about that and addressed it. And it's, yes, there is an aesthetic value to design, but fundamentally it is about solving a problem and coming up with a way to engage with the world that somehow brings us to a point of greater connection, I would say. And so when you then think about design that way, then you think, well, there's a lot of compassion that's called upon, right? If you really want to think about user experience and what that means to develop your sense of empathy, what it means to be able to understand what somebody else might be experiencing, how you can recognize a problem that they have. To give you a more profound example than an iPod, we have a program at Art Center called Design Matters, which is all about social impact design. And our students going to the far corners of the earth and working with communities on real problems that they're experiencing and taking their creative imagination, their problem-solving skills, and rather than something for commerce or technology, but really thinking about how can we resolve this particular problem for this particular community. And they don't do it from a privileged perch in Pasadena. They go and they engage with those communities. They go to an impoverished village outside of Santiago, Chile, to be able to help them solve their water situation. It's a safe water problem where water is trucked into the village a couple of times a week, and how to make sure that that water is safe, how to use that water, and even how they carry that water back to their homes. What kinds of mechanisms can designers help solve so that they're not destroying their bodies as they do that twice a week? What it would mean to have a very inexpensive device that is designed by one of our students that allows them to wash clothes in the home, or for a child to be able to have a shower. There's this one amazing picture of this beautiful three-year-old child who's experiencing a shower for the first time. And what was that shower but a foot pump and a couple of, you know, very inexpensive materials from whatever the equivalent of Home Depot was there that was put together in a way that allowed them to develop those kinds. And the gratitude and the excitement that came from that community toward these students and the meaningful level of educational experience for these students to be able to go down there and engage in these kinds of ways, you know, was phenomenal. And so we don't necessarily just, I don't want to suggest that it's only about beautiful cars and iPods or smartphones, but that there's a deep level of it. So to round out your question, it's about empathy. It's about connection with other human beings. It's about personal expression, which designers don't talk about enough. But one of the interesting things about the writing of this book and talking to designers was they talk on very personal levels about the initial sketches that they create. It echoes very profoundly what you would expect from an artist who's trying to draw on something within to be able to find that expression. And often it's been said, you would never understand my initial sketches. They're just kind of personal. They're like journal entries, really, you know, in terms of as they find their way to a certain kind of solution. Designers also teach us about constraints, and that becomes a really interesting thing too, that the constraints are not perceived as something that limits, but in fact that opens, paradoxically, possibility. That the more you understand the constraint, the more you can begin to wrestle with designing something within that constraint. And everything might begin with the blank page and the kind of open seas of possibility, but all creative activity eventually starts. You know, you have to start navigating the narrows, not the open seas. And it becomes opening night comes, or the book does need to get edited and laid out, or the architect's work needs to be built in construction or whatever. And that's a process where you go from the creative kind of open seas to something that is very much about production and about real things. And in that world, making a movie, you know, lots of people involved, lots of money involved, lots of constraints. But those constraints also allow you to find your way to it, because without them, you would just be continually paddling in those open seas. So it's true for design, it's true for art. I mean, there are all those kinds of connections that exist as well.
Lauren, this is a conversation I can and will continue on at some later stage because it raises so many further questions. But I do want to just say that for those who are regular listeners to Conversing, I hope that what you might consider doing with this podcast is letting the vocabulary and the pictures that Lauren has offered us to be a catalyst for thinking about your life, for thinking about your work, the things that you give your labor to, the things that you are doing with family and friends that can really be contexts in which this improvisational creativity, the honed, skilled creativity, the deep communal creativity, the practical manifestations of imagination can really affect daily life in far more ways than I think we necessarily appreciate. And frankly, as an expression of a God of infinite creativity, it's an invitation to do that. And I think you've given us today, Lauren, another great set of gifts. So thank you very, very much.
A complete delight, Mark. Thank you. It's always so good to be with you and to speak with you. And I learned so much from you. So thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.